Welcome back to Muppets in Space, a Farscape Rewatch podcast on the Incomparable Podcasting Network. This time around, we told you last time, we watched the first two parts of a three-part epic, Season 2, Episode 11, Look at the Princess, Part 1, A Kiss is But a Kiss, and Episode 12, Look at the Princess, Part 2, I think. I'm your host, Eric Scott, and joining me, as always, my fellow co-host, someone who probably would do anything for love, but would not be made into a statue for 80 cycles, Jason Johnson.
Greetings. And while I would do anything for love, I won't do that.
Shout out to the great, late, great Meatloaf.
Yes.
I guess I mentioned last time that I thought this might have been where I started watching Farscape way back 22 years ago.
Never do the math.
I was told there's no math. Back when I was on Sci-Fi Channel, and yeah, I do remember vague bits and pieces of these episodes, mostly the ending of the second episode, episode 12, which, you know, we'll talk about, I'm sure, later, since there's a lot to talk about.
Agreed, though that seems like it would be a interesting way to be introduced to the show, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. There's a ton of stuff going on, so I probably had no clue what I was watching other than just aliens and Muppets and creatures and a lot of like political intrigue, which we'll also talk about later. But yeah, it was it definitely hooked me, obviously, because I watched the rest of the seasons and the whole rest of the episodes and got into all that. So yeah, it definitely hooked me.
But what a weird cliffhanger to end your first little bit of watching on. Anyway.
Yeah, so I don't know if I watched episode 12 first, or I remember the ending of that, but I'm not sure how much I remember about the rest of it. So yeah, I'm not sure which one I started watching. Did I watch the whole trilogy, or just like started in the middle and was like, what the heck? And then I kept watching. So speaking of which, since we got a lot of recap, since there was a lot of stuff going on, pretty plot heavy couple episodes. So let's jump on in. Season 2, Episode 11, Look at the Princess, Part 1, A Kiss is But a Kiss.
By the way, that title should be a little bit longer.
Yeah, so far that's a record for longest Farscape title. I'm sure we'll not remember that for the rest of them, but yeah, for right now, we'll give it the award.
I'm just going to give everyone from now on the award when they're that long. I don't know which one will win, but maybe at the end of the show, we'll have for our final episode, we'll do a bracket or something, but go ahead. Anyway, recap.
Yeah. Maybe during the season recap, we'll look at title links. No, it didn't.
Make a note of that. Anyway.
And the winner of longest episode title? No, okay. Season 2, Episode 11. Off we go. Aaron and John are sitting in Farscape 1 in the maintenance bay, and she's giving him some maneuvering lessons. Because it's so cramped quarters, he winds up smelling her hair and says that Zan gave her something for it. And he says, it smells pretty good. She says, that's not for him to like, it's for her to like. They wind up kissing, but Aaron gets a little frazzled and jumps out, saying she won't be a slave to his hormones. She tries to leave the maintenance bay, but he pulls her up against the bulkhead and asks why she did her hair, and she says to see if he'd notice. He says, yeah, she got his attention. She says that she'll let Zan know he finds her oils pleasing. He says, no, he finds her pleasing, but she leaves. Chiana, who is kind of a fly on the wall in the maintenance bay, tells Crichton that there's too much pressure and Aaron's scared of the future, so why not just live in the moment, which would be a recurring theme throughout these two shows. Pilot then calls everybody to command and tells them that they're target locked by a bunch of Peacekeeper automated defense systems, and Moya can't starburst away because they'll be destroyed. Pilot says it's not Scorpius, as there are no ships around, so it must be the first line of defense for the inhabited star system nearby. A representative from that system is signaling them. Rigel says, you either have to run, fight, or surrender, and Pilot says Moya has chosen surrender, as resistance means death. Rigel wants to speak with that representative, someone's called Counselor Tino, but Crichton holds him back. Aaron and Zion explain to Tino that they have no weapons and are no longer affiliated with the Peacekeepers, and Tino says that he'll allow them to leave. Dargar asks if they can approach the world to get provisions instead, but Tino says that it's impossible during coronation time. On hearing that, Rigel breaks free from Crichton and introduces himself as a Dominar, and asks if Tino would turn away royalty-bearing gifts.
Rigel persuades him. So it's all Rigel's fault. That's what I'm taking from this.
Yeah, if he'd just keep his big mouth shut, and then he'd be fine. But, it'd be a boring episode. So Rigel persuades him, and Tino allows them to approach, but weapons are prohibited. Rigel asks Crichton if he was right, and when Crichton says, yeah, he was right, he says, don't you ever forget it. Although, was he right? We'll find out. Crichton wants to talk to Aaron, but she wants some space. So Crichton asks Tiana if she wants to go down to the planet with him and hang. And then he enters her quarters to find her and Dargo right in the middle of having sex. Oops. Dargo tells Crichton that with Tiana, he's managed to find the moments of pleasure and asks him not to ruin it. The crew, except for Zan, and here we go again, go down to the planet. They go to some kind of bar, and there's a lot of kissing going on. And Crichton asks Aaron if he can buy her a drink for a few words. She bites back and tells him basically to go away. When a woman approaches Crichton with a vial, he says no thank you, but she says it's just for the kiss. She puts a drop of something on her tongue, and then his, and they kiss. She then says sorry, and walks away, leaving Crichton a little bit confused. And Aaron says it's the whole world made for him and his writing instincts. Aaron refuses a kiss from a stranger, but Crichton takes another, and another. Meanwhile, we cut to a woman named Jenna telling a man named Clavor that there's a Sabbatian here who's his sister has never kissed. And nearby Scarron, who we see for the first time, Cargan, tells Clavor that he thought it wouldn't matter. He says that her compatibility was irreversibly contaminated. Clavor will be king. Tino asks Rigel about Crichton, and he says that Princess Catrala is next in line for the throne, but unless she can find a compatible mate, the kingdom will fall to her brother. After Clavor takes some verbal shots at Cargan, Jenna tells him that if he doesn't become king, she won't marry him. Back on Moya, Pilot asks Zan why she didn't go down to the planet, and she says that she values her time alone, but she doesn't get much of that anymore. Pilot says that he and Moya are pleased that she chose to stay again, and he has opened all the doors on that tier. Zan sings, and it echoes all throughout Moya.
And I think that's the first time we've seen that, right?
Yeah, I don't remember her ever singing before. Meditating, obviously, but not singing like that. Hmm. Which is kind of cool. It kind of echoed, and it was nice. Nice little moment there. Back on the planet, Tiana offers Dargo the vial, saying one drop will say whether their DNA is compatible, and they kiss. Unfortunately, it comes out false, but Tiana says that they're only incompatible by DNA. They can still give each other pleasure. Rigel asks Aaron why the Scarron is watching them, and she says that the Scarron wants the same thing as the Peacekeepers wanted, a covenant with this world. A man comes up to Aaron and wants her to take the test with her, but instead she takes it with Rigel and pretends it was positive to get rid of him.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, Sabbatian and Hynerian? I don't know, who knows. Pilot calls Zan, telling her that Scorpius has found them! The command carrier is scanning Moya, so as a decoy from the planet, Zan suggests starbursting away once Scorpius has seen them, and they leave. Back on the planet, Tino asks Crichton if he was once a peacekeeper, and says that his friends have access to the Space Command to find their ship. He asks Crichton to take the test with a woman standing behind him. Crichton says no, but she says please, so fine, he does. Crichton says that tastes sweet, and Tino calls the guards. Clavor gets really upset, and Cargan tells him not to make a scene. Crichton asks what's the big deal, and Tino says it's for his protection. Cargan says if they are compatible, Crichton must die within a day. Dun, dun, dun. Meanwhile, Crichton, still confused, asks Tino what he's doing, and Tino tells him that he's the only compatible Sabbatian they've ever found, the only one capable of giving the princess children. He wants Crichton to consider marrying her. Crichton says, no, that's crazy, but Tino says he would be regent. Clavor then enters to see Crichton, but Tino won't leave Crichton alone with him. Probably a smart idea. Clavor tells Crichton that he'll speak with him later. Tino tells Crichton that if Catrala doesn't wed within a matter of days, Clavor will take the throne. Meanwhile, Aaron speaks with Tiana and Dargo, and Tiana tells her that Crichton is in custody. Aaron is mad, and Tiana blames Aaron for rejecting him and getting them into this mess in the first place. Dargo says Rigel is with Crichton, and they'll wait for Moya to return. Aaron takes Tiana to show her where Crichton is. Dargo, however, stays sitting at the table when Scorpius appears and approaches Dargo and just wants to talk. Cargan is surprised by Scorpius' appearance and says that Crichton must be working for him so that the Peacekeepers gain an advantage with Clavor's dynasty. Crichton tells Dargo that he won't marry the princess, but Rigel, however, says he should. Dargo says that Scorpius offered him a deal, amnesty for the others, and he won't destroy Crichton's brain in exchange for access to Crichton's wormhole technology, floating somewhere in his head. Dargo told Scorpius that he'd speak to Crichton about it to stall for time. Rigel says that as long as Crichton pretends, he increases their chance of survival, but Crichton says that he will tell Catrala no. Meanwhile, Pilot tells Zan that the carrier did not follow them, so Zan tells him to plot a course back to the planet. Crichton tells Clavor that he won't marry Catrala when Catrala and the Empress enter. The Empress asks Crichton if he's proposed yet, and he says no, he doesn't love her daughter. She tells him that Clavor can't succeed as he will betray her people to the Scarrons, costing millions of lives. Crichton's purpose is to keep the world stable. Crichton says that's great, but there's nothing she can say to make him marry her daughter. But right then, Scorpius enters, saying that he's been searching for Crichton all this time, and tells him to make the right decision. The Empress says it's either her daughter or Scorpius, so Crichton asks Catrala what she wants. She says she wants to be Empress, to have kids, and to keep the peace, and she will not make him miserable. She says she's sorry. Crichton is kind of backed into a corner and is forced to propose, and she accepts.
The Empress is very well informed about Scorpius.
Yeah, I have questions, which we'll get to later, about that too, so we'll see. Schemes within schemes. Aaron's disappointed with Crichton's choice, and a cousin of the princess named Dragon congratulates Crichton and introduces himself to Aaron. Crichton asks her to find a way out, as they still haven't heard from Moya. Outside, Catrala tells Tano that she can't believe her mother will force her to marry Crichton because she loves him. Tano says he loves her too, but she must do as her mother wishes. Aaron's kind of overhearing the conversation, standing a little off in the distance there. Aaron tells Chiana and Dargo that Catrala doesn't love Crichton and gets angry with Chiana. Chiana says that she's really angry at herself for letting Crichton go and points out that Dragon keeps coming onto her. Aaron just says that this marriage is wrong and leaves. Back on Moya, Pilot tells Zan that Moya is now following a familiar signal, moving further away from the planet. Aaron is confronted by Kargan, who gives her a message for Scorpius. He tells her that Scorpius's presence will not be tolerated, and they get into a fight because Aaron is not forthcoming with information. She's kind of getting dragged across the room, basically, unfortunately, until the Empress interrupts and gives them both stern warnings. Rigel tells Aaron not to dissuade Crichton from the marriage. Tano asks what species Crichton is, and he says that the Empress has ordered his true identity a secret. He tells Crichton that Catrala's DNA was poisoned by her brother, he believes with the help of the Scaran. Catrala calls Crichton, and through a machine, shows him what their son would look like, and says that he would be healthy. Crichton is overwhelmed, obviously. Tano says that he must work on the pose for his statue. Crichton poses like the Queen of England, waving, but Tano says it's hardly one he'd like to hold for 80 cycles. Say what? Meanwhile, Kargan tells Clavor that they must assassinate Crichton, but when Clavor argues, Kargan probes both his and Jenna's mind with his Scaran abilities, which we haven't seen Scorpius use, so interesting, we'll get into that later too. Meanwhile, Moya has arrived at some point in space, where it's like almost like a mist nebula, which appears to be alive. Moya is being evasive with Pilot, but he does know what it is, the Builders, Moya's creators. Crichton walks in on Chiana and Dargo doing the wild thing again, and tells Dargo about the statue situation, oblivious to what's going on in front of him, apparently. It's to watch over the people and absorb all the facets of their system, as they can see and hear everything as statues. Dargo says that he must go through with it, but Crichton says that everybody he knows will be dead. But then again, the alternative is Scorpius. The hope for him was that he'd see them all again, and without his hope, he is nothing. Dargo says that he will no longer have Scorpius after him. He'll have power, a family, and it could be his destiny. Dargo says that their time together was good, but he must look beyond his fear and see the path ahead of him. Crichton speaks with the royal servant, Runa, when Aaron enters. He says that the marriage is better than Scorpius, who's in his head, at the back of his mind, all the time, and he scares him. Aaron says that there's never been anything they couldn't overcome together, but Crichton says accept each other. Aaron says that she can't come to the wedding, but he says he needs her there. She asks what else they can say but goodbye, and leaves. Soon after that, a group of men enter and attack Crichton. He fights them off for a bit, but eventually they overpower him. As a present from Clavor, they say, they fire a weapon at him, and he begins to dissolve. To be continued. Alright, some trivia. The title, A Kiss is But a Kiss, comes from the song As Time Goes By from Casablanca. The trilogy title, Look at the Princess, comes from an inside joke between Rockne O'Bannon and David Kemper. It had become a gag phrase during production in the first season. Kemper's original idea for the story was a fairy tale that had Crichton getting married, having a child, and being a statue for 80 years. When a freelance writer declined to write the story based on that pitch, Kemper himself decided to write it. The trilogy was originally intended and shot as a two-part episode. When they decided to expand it into a three-parter, they had to write and shoot several additional scenes. I can probably guess which ones those are. These additional 14 scenes were directed by Andrew Prowse and spaced throughout the 3 hours. But the original two-episode portions were directed by Tony Tilse, or Tilsey, I don't know, so they shared the credit. The exterior scenes with the Scaran were filmed in the Chinese Gardens in Sydney. And finally, during the scene where Aaron kisses Rigel, Claudia Black's cell phone went off, meaning she had to buy a case of beer for the crew. So I guess that's one of those little actor stage things, I don't know, it's kind of funny. Alright, so that was a gigantic recap, because it's a gigantic episode. So, what did you think of part one?
So, spoiler alert, and we'll probably get into this as we go, but these multi-part episodes are pretty much my sweet spot for any time we seem to hit them. So, I thoroughly enjoyed this one, and I can't speak to the third one because we haven't got there yet, but I think that seems to hold true so far. I'll say that.
Yeah, because I guess with the multi-parts, obviously they can, you know, do better justice to the story. You know, they have more time to flesh things out. And like I said before, this is a lot to fit into just the first episode. You know, you kind of have to set up all the characters, you know, the main characters, where they're at, supporting characters, even bring on recurring characters like, you know, Scorpius and company. Although I'm still kind of wondering about this guy that keeps hitting on Erin. He keeps coming. It's about like two or three times he came onto her during the whole first episode. So guessing hopefully there's more to him than just like a comedy bit or, you know, jilted lover kind of thing. I don't know. So at least for the first two episodes, he's nobody, but we'll see if that develops in the final episode.
Yeah, I mean, he does continue. He shows up in the second episode and still going. But yeah, that seems like an odd thing they spend a lot of time with just to be an annoying guy. So we'll see if that comes back.
Yeah, because I mean, it's obvious Erin's not interested in him, at least now. So it's just trying to like set up like the, not like a love triangle, but like, you know, her and John aren't getting together, and now John's with Catrala, so is she gonna be like, oh, okay, fine, I'll just go off with him? Like, I don't know. I hope it's not that shallow. I don't know.
No, and I think she's pretty much made it clear that she has no intention of that regardless, so.
Yeah, sometimes reading into something that's not there. But speaking of something we do know, that John and Erin have already slept together back in the fake John Goes Back to Earth kind of thing. So they do have feelings for each other. But for some reason, Erin can't or won't commit to anything more than, I guess, wherever they're at now. Like, she wants to keep it kind of wherever the fate, whatever phase they're at now, however you want to call it, right? You know, she keeps making excuses to, like, not take it further, but yet she does kind of take it further, like, with the hair oil. So, I guess I'm confused. She's confused. I don't know. It's kind of confusing.
Yeah, at this stage, I'm not sure what her reasons are. Obviously, the rest of the crew on Moya know that they're close to being a thing. I mean, Chiana pretty much lays it out for them. But at the same time, you know, I don't know what her reasons are. She's just making excuses. But you kind of just got to chalk it up to the writers not feeling like they're far enough into the show to wanting them to hit that point. So we'll just keep going. But yeah, we're definitely getting close, right? I mean, there's not much they can do here but make a move one way or the other.
And when I was watching that, I was kind of thinking of, I don't know if you ever watched Moonlighting back in the 80s with Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
Can't say but that like I did.
Okay. But they had like, it was like a multi-season show. Like, it was kind of like a detective kind of thing, but, you know, show. They had like a sexual chemistry between the two of them. Like, would they or won't they? You know, they like each other, but they're just playing off each other. And then when they finally slept together at the end of one of the seasons, it was like kind of like a jumping the shark kind of thing. Like, after that, the season just, the rest of the show just kind of died. Like, it just, you know, that was the show, basically, was their chemistry. And that just kind of ruined it. So that's not where Farscape is going, because I've, you know, obviously seen ahead. But it's just, you know, it's not kind of like one of those things where it's like, they aren't going to play it for that, where it's like, they're going to keep that tension going for, you know, until the show ends, right? They're going to at some point commit, you know.
And that's good, because just I don't know, it only qualifies as a spoiler, but a personality trait I have, I guess, is hang up. I can't tolerate that will they, won't they for too long. I mean, if it stretches past a couple seasons, I'm generally kind of frustrated with it. So it's good to know that they don't plan to go that route. You know, and it's a trope, right? I mean, we have that in a lot of shows. I keep thinking of like Castle, or take your pick of any of the pairing mismatched male lead, female lead shows that they play this off of. But you know, I generally enjoy when those shows get past that more than I do the setup.
And speaking of relationships that are now firmly going, Dargo and Chiana are now a couple for sure. You know, glad it's working out so far. You know, even though they're not compatible DNA-wise, because, you know, that little vial, whatever that is, said they weren't, you know, they don't care. You know, they can still be in love and have fun and enjoy each other's company. So I'm glad for them. I love it.
I love that, too. It's great that they get past that. Again, they didn't hang on to that will they, won't they for very long, right? They, as fits these characters, these are not, like John and Erin, these aren't characters who are going to sit around and think about something for terribly long. They're just going to act on it. And true to form, they do. I will mention, though, that I do question the validity of that magic oil.
Oh, come on. It's great. It's better than any kind of dating app. You just put, you know, oil on your tongues, and if it's sweet, you're perfect. That's better than Tinder and whatever else. I know what's out, whatever's out there. I don't know.
True. But, well, and I say that as somebody has, let me clarify.
Maybe, no experience, I don't know. Yeah,
no experience right. with those apps. However, I will say that I can't get past the fact that as a society that's evolved that heavily, I can't see they just don't do those same marker testings, some other less, let's say, fluid transfer-y way, and get it from a more traditional scan.
Yeah, but that's boring. You get to have, like, you know, these soirees, and you get to run around and kiss everybody, and I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, you would think, though, that they could, at birth, catalog those markers and just build a automatic list of age compatible mates at a certain point, right? Like, okay, you've reached the age. Here's your list of people in this area who, you know, are on the planet, whatever, that match you. And, you know, let's save some party time.
And that would kind of solve the problem that they're having right now of who's compatible with the princess. It's like, well, we just consult the genetic records and here's the guy over here somewhere. Okay, done. You
know. Well, and then it would, I guess it is common knowledge that the princess got her DNA altered. That would obviously show up in the scan if she differs from her original at birth scan, right? Because if they had a before and after, they seem to me to be able to figure out how to fix what went wrong.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, well, obviously plot, but yeah, the point of, you know, they do have advanced technology to find out if you're compatible, but maybe not that much to like undo something. Like, obviously it's not natural because the Skarn or Claivor, with the Skarn's help, you know, somehow poisoned her DNA somehow, right? So
right, and we'll assume that it's the Skarn's technology that allowed them to alter her DNA and not one of theirs, and that's why they're still hanging on to it.
And speaking of said Skarn, we finally get to see what a Skarn looks like. We know what, you know, Scorpius is kind of like the half Skarn, so we kind of know vaguely what a Skarn might look like. We thought, but nope. Looks totally different, which, you know, nice job again by the creature shop to, not in a row, but in the last couple of episodes, they've done a good job with extra creatures. And I guess, you know, he's there to try to get this world to get a treaty or become allies with them or something. I don't know. They didn't quite make it too clear, but, and you know, obviously they're doing whatever they can do. You know, this is where the political intrigue comes in. You know, they're messing with the DNA. They're trying to pit the one guy against his, you know, who's probably more sympathetic to their causes or bribes or whatever to, you know, become their puppet ruler or whatever, you know, to get this treaty done or whatever.
I will say, though, I'm not quite sure I follow the dynamic between the Skarns and the Sabbatians. It seems like the Sabbatians / Peacekeepers are pretty good at making an enemy of everybody. So I'm guessing that these are supposed to be their particular nemesis. But then that kind of leads to the question of, I'm really confused about Scorpius, because there's, having now seen a full Skarn, I have questions.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that the Skarn and the Peacekeepers don't like each other, as we've kind of seen from other scenes later. So there must be some kind of, I don't know if they've ever been to war with each other, or the Peacekeepers want to keep the peace or control other planets, and maybe the Skarns, you know, obviously don't want that control. So it's just a kind of political rivalry, economic, who knows? I don't know. Obviously, hopefully they'll explain that as the series goes on. I don't know.
Speaking of Scorpius, I did want to jump in with a mention that we also, I can't remember honestly if it's this episode or next, I didn't make a note, but we do get to see his head cylinder exchange again. Mm-hmm. So
yep, always good. Always
odd,
creepy.
Odd creepy callback to that. I do hope one day we get that explained, since I'm not sure if that's a thing to hold his Skarn whatever's in check, or if it's something else to do with something else creepy about him.
Yeah, because we do see the Skarns have some kind of abilities. Like, he pointed his hand at the two Claivor and her, his Jenna girlfriend or whatever, and something came out or something did something. So can Scorpius do that? Or is that just he lost that because he's not full-blooded Skarn? I don't know. So maybe there's parts of Skarn physiology that, being a half Skarn, you have to somehow keep cool. Because it's like a cooling rod in his head to keep something cool. So it's like, is he like heating up by not being able to like use that power? I don't know. It's interesting. Hopefully they'll explain that later.
And slight tangent, because maybe I missed it. Was that power from his hand? Because I thought he breathed something out, but maybe I just was looking at it wrong.
Maybe it was breathing, yeah, I forget.
It just,
yeah, it's some kind of like hazy wave. Yeah, it might have been his breath, actually, which is, again, weird, but okay, fine.
Yeah, that was even weirder to me, so I was like, wait, how's this, what are we doing here?
Yeah. And I guess, speaking of our favorite half Skarn, or, well, only half Skarn, how does Scorpius get to be there? It seems kind of convenient for plot, but like, were they in the neighborhood because they were chasing John and them, or were told to go there because the coronation was due or coming up, so they want to try and plead their case to get them to join the peacekeeper side. I don't think the queen knew who Crichton was, or that they were wanted by the peacekeepers, and like called Scorpius over like, "Hey, I found your guys." So right now, kind of confused. We'll see next episode if that gets any better. But
yeah, I'll revisit this when we get to the next episode because that adds a couple other layers to it. But I'll say at least for this episode that I don't, other than the plot, right? I don't understand why Scorpius is there. And I'm just going to, again, call out how impressive it is that as soon as he arrives, the queen already has him nailed down and uses him as a pressure point against John, like, almost immediately.
Yeah, and to much effect, because Crichton's like, "Oh, crap. Oh, well, everybody's Moira's gone. I got no choice. Hey, I'll marry your daughter." So
yeah, the most competent person I've seen on this show at this point, I think, is the queen. So,
Yep. Never let a crisis go to waste. Yep, she's right on it. Yep. Oh, I see you hate you and him have a thing going. Oh, you don't like him? Hey, my daughter, and you have protection. Hey, huh?
Exactly. Chess master right there.
And it is kind of hilarious that the Skaren thinks that Crichton and Moya's crew are working with Scorpius, I guess, to try to get the peacekeepers, I guess, one up on the Skarens. And of course, they just play along because it's just hilarious. Like, we know what's going on. So, yeah, sure, you're right. Yeah.
Well, and as true for most villains, right? He sees exactly what he himself would do. So I think that's an awesome in character move, right? That he just assumes that they're doing what he would do in their place. So,
and yeah, I think we already mentioned that Crichton pinches back into a corner. He's got no alternative. They can't escape the planet, so it's either Scorpius or the marriage. And well, that's an easy choice. Although Aaron does make a good point of, well, just run away. Just run away outside the city. And that might work for a little while. I don't know. But then if Moya comes back, how are you going to get back on Moya? So,
and that seems short-sighted to me because Aaron's usually more tactical. And that seems, they've been trying to run from Scorpius on a galactic scale. And she wants to hide from him on a planet that he knows where they're on. It seems a little localized. And I don't know. It didn't seem tactically smart. So,
yeah, because he would never leave the planet if he knows Crichton's down there. So he would stay up in orbit, or they would search, or the queen, would put an APB out on him because he's supposed to marry his daughter. So it's like, there's nowhere he can run at this point. So yeah, I mean, really, it's the only logical thing he could do is bite the bullet and take one for the team,
Right.
Although then he finds out he's going to be a statue for 80 years, and that's still the best alternative. So, that really sucks if that's your best alternative, right?
Right. It's definitely playing the long game. The longest game we've seen in the series so far. I do want to call out here also, we get an interesting mention that I always laugh when I hear, because it's a DK reference. And those always make me laugh because, remember him from episode 1? It's the only time we've ever met this character. So,
yeah, Crichton's best friend, best buddy, fellow scientist who helped came up with, getting him where he is now. And he's been name-dropped, twice in 20 or 30 episodes now?
Hey, he didn't even get to make an appearance on that dream planet, whatever it was called, where the alien was recreating Crichton's return to Earth. So,
yeah, or even back in the Aurora chair. You couldn't even do a clip of him. I guess you couldn't pay him royalties for appearance. I guess he got to cut him out.
Right, exactly. Evidently, he doesn't own the DK name, but we're not going to ever see the guy. So, move on.
Yeah. And then we have, let's shelve Zan and Pilot and Moya, because Zan went down the planet, you have Pilot all by himself up there, and that's boring. So, at least they do something with them. And it was a good plan. Let's try and, hey, Scorpius, over here, look, and then leave the planet, and hopefully they would follow. Which they didn't, because I guess they were there maybe for the coronation, not for the crew. Although, bonus, they were down there anyway. But I guess that's why they want to chase Moya. And then they go off to this weird cloud thing with the creators. And like, okay, I think I know which scenes they probably added to make it a three-parter, I'm guessing.
That's a good point. I wasn't sure, but that does make sense. It's definitely a B-plot. Again, not a fan of Zan getting shelved. For an episode, I mean, I realize she gets some decent time, especially in the next episode, but it's And maybe it's important in the third episode because we haven't seen that yet. But yeah, this is just a side quest that feels like they're just moving them off the board so they're not in the way so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting concept that, you know, these are Moya's, or this cloud thing is where Moya was born or created. So it's okay, it's kind of cool. I get some backstory. Like, we like backstory on our characters. But yeah, it's kind of like, did we need that in this episode to make it three parts? I guess you want to make it three parts to draw out your commitment to the Sci-Fi Channel or whatever, or to maybe build up the other two-parter, you know, other two parts better. Okay, I'll give them that. So, and this hasn't been dull or boring yet, so we'll see where they go with it.
Agreed. I don't dislike the concept. I think it would have been a good separate episode. You maybe even replace one of the less great episodes of the season with a standalone and have everybody on board for it. So, you know, there's things they could have done with it. The storyline, it just seems shoehorned into this one.
Yep, I agree. All right, so shall we jump into the exciting middle part of the trilogy?
Yeah, I'll take the middle child.
Okay, yep, there you go. It's not the stepchild, it's the middle child. It's not.
We'll go with that. And again, spoilers, we liked all these, so that's not a slight. Season 2, Episode 12, Look at the Princess, Part 2, I Do, I Think. As Crichton is about to be dissolved by the assassins, Jenna saves him, downing all of the guards. That was quick. She tells him that she's a disruptor of the Peacekeeper Special Directorate and asks Crichton which branch he's from. Crichton plays along, saying that he didn't know he'd be getting backup. She says that she's to stay close to Claybor, and if he assumes the throne, she will kill him. She says that she will kill Crichton if he wavers and jeopardizes her mission. Crichton confronts Claybor, and after punching him, says that he's not happy that he was nearly killed and wants off this planet. Jenna is behind a silk screen, and Rona enters. Crichton says that he wants Scorpius off his back. Catrella is able to marry who she wants, and he can be king. He warns Claybor not to try to kill him again, and when he leaves, Claybor orders Rona to get his mother. Crichton is telling Tino what happened, with Dargo backing him up, but Chiana is skeptical, and Tino says that he can find no evidence of the attack on Crichton. He believes Crichton, though, and will upgrade security, but he can't accuse Claybor without proof. Catrella enters and slaps Crichton, then takes him to a room where she tells him he's made a fool out of her. She knows Claybor poisoned her DNA, but she doesn't believe that he'd kill anyone. The Empress now considers Crichton unstable and wants more tests of him. Catrella refuses to believe him, accusing him of lying, and if so, she can't marry him. Back on Moya, smoke has infiltrated her, and Zan goes to see what it is. A being comes out of it, proclaiming himself to be Kahanu, who gave Moya a soul. He says that Moya is well and gave birth, but to a gunship. He says that he created these ships as beings of peace, but Moya's offspring can dispense carnage. He is here to decommission Moya and end her existence.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, because I have lots of questions about that. So.
Yeah. Aaron and Chiana are outside the palace, with Chiana trying to convince Aaron that she needs to tell Crichton how she feels. Dragon approaches and offers himself as a diversion, wanting her to go to the Barren Lands with him. Aaron refuses point blank, saying she doesn't like him. Meanwhile, Catrella still refuses to believe Crichton when a floating robot comes into the room. The door is locked and the machine releases gas into the room. Rona enters to lead Crichton and Catrella away before they fall unconscious. Catrella apologizes for doubting Crichton. She will marry him. Rigel is talking to Empress Novia, but she refuses to let Crichton leave the planet and continues to deny Claybor's involvement. Rigel suggests that she stash Crichton somewhere, and she says that Rona has a ship full of gifts in orbit that they can use. Rigel suggests that they tell no one, not even Moya's crew, to throw the assailants off the scent so they become careless. Rigel asks Novia if she trusts Rona, and she says that Rona will not betray them. Really? We cut to a scene where Rona receives money from Scorpius as a down payment for her work, with the rest to come upon the completion of her mission. Scorpius wants no witnesses left behind. On the transport, Rona gives Crichton the tracking device that Scorpius gave her to stop anyone from knowing where they are going. Meanwhile, cut back to Moya, who's shutting down her systems in sequence as Zan tries to stop her, telling Keanu that all life cherishes life. She's not convinced that Moya is doing this willingly, so Keanu says that he will let her do the convincing. Moya speaks, saying that she's fulfilled and will go willingly in peace, making Zan extremely upset. Back on the planet, Dargo is upset at Rigel for not saying Crichton was leaving, while Tino says that the transport disappeared and no signal has been received. Dargo thinks it's Scorpius, while Eren seems to think it's the Scarran. Chiana goes to speak with the Scarran this time. Crichton wonders why Rona's ship is so far away from the others, and Crichton and Rona discuss possessions, because she claims to have none. Meanwhile, Catrella and Jenna are both in the ladies' room when Eren comes in and presses both of them up against the mirror, warning them that what will happen if anything happens to Crichton. Claybor tells Cargan what Crichton did to him, but neither of them gassed him. Chiana enters the room, and Cargan tells her to leave. She tries to tell them that the Na'Bari will get retribution if anything happens to Crichton. She leaves, and Cargan realizes that they don't know where Crichton is either. Crichton, Rona, and the guards board her ship when the guards are shot. A gun is put to Crichton's head by Lieutenant Bracca, who tells Rona to notify Scorpius. The transport is cut loose, and Rona wants payment. Scorpius appears as an image and congratulates Crichton. When Rona asks for payment, Scorpius tells Bracca to give her something special. Scorpius tells Crichton that Dargo just visited him and doesn't seem to know where he is. Crichton asks what he wants, and Scorpius says that the wormhole technology in his brain makes him unique in the galaxy, and unique is always valuable. Crichton starts acting mad, knowing that Bracca won't shoot him, but tries to get him to. Crichton starts punching controls, and Bracca can't control him. Crichton has engaged weapons, and the world's auto defenses will fire if they don't identify themselves. When they don't comply, the defenses fire, and as Bracca tries to get control, Rona attacks Crichton and ends up getting electrocuted. Bracca calls Crichton insane and leaves the ship with the only spacesuit and helmet. Comms are down when Crichton suddenly hears Scorpius' voice telling him to focus and that he must survive. Crichton picks up a gun, and as the ship is destroyed, Crichton jumps out into open space, using the force of the gunfire to carry him over to the transport pod. Zan summons Keanu and asks him to build pilot a new ship so that he does not perish as well. Keanu refuses and tells her to say goodbye. Crichton is laying on a table with a breathing apparatus on his face. Dargo says that he's spoken with the Empress and she won't do anything. She's put everyone on notice. Crichton asks what he can do, and Dargo says either run away or stay here. He'll back Crichton whatever he chooses. Eren enters and Dargo leaves them alone. She says that she's proud of Crichton for being the John she always knew, fighting, resisting, never giving up. Crichton asks if she stopped Scorpius chasing him or convinced the Empress to make him marry the princess. She says there's no reason to get married. Crichton says that 80 cycles isn't that long if it'll stop Claybor from taking the throne and save lives. He says he's tired and asks what he's supposed to do when there's no fight left. Eren says that he runs away and asks, "With you?" She says with all of them, together, but at her response, he just lies down on the bed. She says that he can't quit, but he says he just can't go on. Eren asks if he's no longer the Crichton she knew, but he doesn't answer, and she leaves. She goes to Dragon and asks him to explore the Barren Lands if he thinks he can keep up. Crichton is left on the bed all alone.
Aww.
Pyla tells Zan that Moya has slipped from his consciousness, and he will soon follow. He tells Zan not to feel sad. His life was good and Moya was right. They are fulfilled. Zan says it's been a pleasure, and Pilot says he's ready now. He has seen the stars.
Aww.
Oh, it's getting worse.
I know.
Crichton is in the hall for the wedding, and Scorpius tells him that he's making a mistake. Crichton tells him that his one request for a wedding present was that Scorpius be banned from the planet forever, and they said yes. The wedding ceremony takes place with everyone but Eren in attendance. When it's over, Crichton asks Dargo where Eren was, but Dargo says to forget about her. Crichton gives Chiana recordings for Pilot, Zan, and Eren, and Chiana hugs him and says she loves him. Catrella is turned into a statue, and Tino says that it's calibrated only for Sabaetians, so endure the pain and rule wisely. Dargo says he has good news and bad news. The bad, he's married, and he must endure 80 cycles as a statue on a strange world. The good, he and Chiana are having fantastic sex. He and Crichton laugh as Crichton is painfully turned into a statue. Aww. To be concluded, next time. A little trivia here. Andrew Prowse referred to this trilogy as a pretty ambitious little episode, in a joking manner. He went on to note that Crichton's scene in the Jinkish cockpit was one of his favorites from the show. The original episode of the two-parter would have removed the wedding sequence to fit in the required time. Originally, Dave Elsley was to play Rona. The demand of his work prevented this, however, and Francesca Buehler, Ben Browder's real-life wife, gained her second role on the show. Buehler's inspiration for Rona's voice came from an old BBC record she had of the Beatrix Potter story, The Tale of Ms. Tiggy Winkle. The concept that the builders were formed from steam harkens back to the original idea for the peacekeepers and that they were going to be steam troopers, soldiers made from steam.
Which would have been a really different show if they did that.
Yeah. Good thing that idea went up in smoke. John's brief trip through the vacuum of space flies in the face of general convention, suggesting that this means instant death. See, dream a little dream. This is, in fact, scientifically accurate, as a human being can survive for over a minute in a vacuum. Something I did not know.
No, me either. I thought they were like, the eyes would explode, or maybe it's just like the Arnold Schwarzenegger on Mars thing. What was that one called?
Total Recall.
Yeah, where he's outside, his eyes are bulging out of his head.
Although
that's not a vacuum. This is like almost a vacuum.
I guess if you're there when the vacuum's created, maybe? I don't know. There's some questions. While captured by Bracca on Rona's ship, Crichton acts out the self-hostage scene from Blazing Saddles and the scene from Aliens where the character Hudson freaks out. Any thoughts on this one? What'd you think?
So again, wow. Lots of things going on. It's, you know, jam-packed, you know, episode from start to finish. You know, you're not bored, or there's no, like, filler, although we can argue about the Zan and Moya thing. And I guess now that we know it's only going to be a two-parter, and I am kind of glad that they did add the extra scenes and pad things out to make it a three-parter, because it would have been a lot rushed to try and pull this into two parts. So I'm kind of glad that they're taking their time, building things out, giving us a lot of things to think about, and we laugh, we cry, you know, you're running like the emotional gamut here of, you know, getting frustrated with, you know, Aaron and John and all that kind of stuff. So I'm glad that they really took their time and just made this so far two amazingly solid episodes.
I'll second that. It's two-parter. I'll second that. But, you know, especially, I definitely enjoy the pacing, and especially if the scenes that got added were stuff like the wedding scene and things like that, not just the builder stuff, because again, we could talk about whether it could survive without that. But things like the wedding scene and any other on-planet scenes, there's really not any of those I've seen so far that I would take out. They've all been important or enjoyable or both.
Speaking of things that I don't want to say could have been taken out, but let's talk about the Moya stuff up front, and we can forget about it until the next episode, where hopefully they wrap that up too. Well, they will, because obviously they have no ship if they'll wrap it up. So
there won't be any escape in Farscape. Let's put it that way.
That's right. Yeah, it'd be no escape. Yeah. So I mean, it's not bad or boring, like we said before, and it's a nice diversion from the political and romantic intrigue going on, right? You kind of get wrapped up in that, and okay, let's take a break and go over here for a little bit and do something totally different and come back to the fun. But I guess my biggest nitpick, not nitpick, but just general being the logical programmer person that I am, is with this Kahanyu guy or being or whatever. You know, if you're that powerful and you've either created sentient spacefaring creatures, which is pretty cool, or found existing spacefaring creatures and made them sentient, wouldn't you kind of know that Moya didn't, by her own volition, make an offspring with weapons and other parts like that? Like, wouldn't you know that it was manipulated by a foreign entity? Like, if you built these things or created these things, you would know what they can and can't do, right? So why do you think like you think and you have to kill Moya because she did something you didn't want her to do or something? I don't get it.
You would think that the person they want to decommission would be the peacekeepers, right? Or the people they would want to decommission would be the peacekeepers. I mean, the peacekeepers were the one that weaponized and modified his creation. It does seem interesting to hold that against the creation instead of the person doing the modifying.
Right, because, I mean, you would either have talked to Moya or can read Moya's mind or whatever.
Well, he can make Moya talk. So
yeah, so wouldn't you then have access to her memories and know that she didn't do this? It was foisted upon her by the peacekeepers, and the whole episodes we learned about where Pilot came on board and all that kind of stuff. It's like, so you're holding something against her, you're going to kill her for something that she didn't do. And then she still loves Talon. She still wants to be reunited with Rosspring. So she still has that motherly, you know, she's not like just, you know, spitting out, you know, weapon babies and be like, wee, you know, no, I mean, so I just don't get it.
Well, and I don't know if we ever get there. Maybe throughout the rest of the show, we'll get some more explanation. But now I'll be honest, I'm really confused about Moya's makeup and you know, does a Leviathan not need a pilot? Is that something that was not part of the original design at all? And the actual need for a pilot at all comes from something the Peacekeepers did. It just, again, I'm slightly confused, but maybe that's okay. And I do want to mention that it's not that I don't like this plot. I think there's a lot of world building we're getting out of Moya's history and the builders and stuff that potentially is really important and interesting. I just feel like it doesn't fit in this episode, and I would pay it way more attention if I didn't have all this other stuff going on, right? If this was the standalone and the focus of the episode, it would have my attention. And right now, I just want to get back to see what happens to Crichton and the group. So I think it's poorly served with where they put it, is what I'll say.
Yeah, because I mean, there's enough in here to make it its own episode, standalone, full 48 minutes or whatever, 45 minutes, whatever. You could really do good justice and delve deep into morality and all that good sci-fi stuff you cloak around, you know, those kind of issues and stuff. They have really done probably a stand-up episode all by itself on that one.
Absolutely. And if they wanted to keep it to just Zan for some reason, they could, you know, have the rest of them be down on a planet trading or something when she has to take off and do the same thing and just kind of have them off if they wanted to focus on Zan being the only person on board and still do that as part of a regular episode. Again, I think we beat that to death. I just want to make sure that I communicated that I did like the plot. I just didn't like where they used it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. That's why that's probably what we think of. Maybe they filled it out to make it longer and probably expand other things too, but that's probably the B plot popped in to make it three episodes. All right, enough of that. Back to political intrigue. Speaking of which, so the Peacekeepers do have some kind of a spy or agent on the planet. You know, she's basically going to, if Clavor becomes king, then she's right there with him. And, oh, he's going to die on the wedding night or die before they can do the statue thing. And, oh, well, what a shame.
So. Yeah, I hate sand too. Wait, no, sorry. That's the wrong political intrigue in space.
Well, the Barren Lands, never mind.
Oh, gosh. Is that next episode? Tatooine all over again. No. I have thoughts on maybe the fact that we've got the Peacekeeper intrigue and the agent undercover is part of why Scorpius was there, and it wasn't just, you know, because of plot. It would have been nice to have that explained a little better, but I can headcanon that.
Yeah, I mean, the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm thinking that, yeah, Scorpius is just there to either follow up on, because obviously this is probably an important planet. It broke away from the Peacekeepers however many hundreds of cycles ago, and I guess they haven't wanted to, like, take it over militarily, so they're going to try and do it another way. They're going to put somebody in.
And we did get the throwaway line almost that we were a couple days away from the brother being able to take the throne. So maybe he was there to see him ascend and be there for when his agent kills him, right? Because if that was the plan, if Clavor gets crowned and then she kills him, then maybe Scorpius gets to come in and do something.
Yeah, or get her off planet or whatever or something, yeah. But it is kind of funny that, again, everybody thinks that Crichton and company are in on it. So now she thinks that he's another Peacekeeper plant who's going to marry Catrala as a way to get them, I guess, submitted to the Peacekeeper side of things while she's trying to stop the Skaren side of things, which is kind of cool. And yeah, Crichton's like, yep, you got it. I can't tell you anything about it because it's even more secret than your mission, you know.
Yeah, his superpower is timing. So,
right place at the wrong time or wrong place at the right time, whatever. And yeah, you know, we have our double crossing, triple crossing, schemes within schemes. So that's, I kind of like that kind of stuff. I always like the political kind of intrigue. Like, you know, that was the most enjoyable thing about like lots of these kind of shows. Like obviously the Game of Thrones, that's the whole point of Game of Thrones, is scheming within scheming and to double cross everybody to get what you want. This is obviously the before that and lower budget version of it. So it's kind of cool. And you know, Scorpius is now like the third option here, whatever, you know, he's doing what he can do to get John away and break things up. You know, he's bribed Catrala's servant who can never be bribed. She's rock solid, no problem. Next scene, oops, hey, you know. So
Yeah,
so, he's got all sides covered here.
There was definitely a nice setup there, although I would be interested to see how he actually convinced her of what wealth was and why she should want it, because she seems to have no grasp of it, which seems to contradict them bringing gifts. If they have no possessions, what are they giving? But yeah, she's an interesting character that I'm not quite sure how you bribe an unbribable, except for the fact that he's Scorpius.
Yeah, I had some of those same kind of questions, and she was kind of mentioning something like that when they're going up to her ship or her species ship, whatever, representative ship, whatever, and she's talking about possessions and money or something. She's trying to confuse about it, so, but that she's like, she wanted it, like she doesn't know what it is, but she wants it. Like, okay, I mean, I don't know, I guess you see other people on the planet with stuff, and you know, she can see them like manipulating people to get stuff, so maybe she's like, that sounds kind of fun, maybe I want to try that, I don't know.
And she'd have been safer to do that and just take the gifts and call them hers, but you know, instead of even going to the planet at all. But what do I know?
Yeah, I mean, unless they know that her, which that's confusing too. Like, if she's the Empress's or the Catrala's like servant, but then obviously she's not the species from that. She's not Sabbatian, so she's some species. I don't know. They didn't say. But yet they also brought gifts. So the timing of that, maybe she's already there as like just a servant or something. And then her planet also sent gifts. I don't know. But anyway. Not important, but just kind of weird. Just didn't quite make sense, but didn't really have to, I guess. Speaking of gifts, we have probably one of the better set pieces of either these two episodes or in a while. I mean, it was, I love the whole transport scene. It was just hilarious. You think he's going to go to hide. Obviously, Scorpius knows he's there because they set him up that way.
Well, and you get John piloting up there because he refused to let anybody else drive. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, because he wants to know where he's going, right? He's in control as much as he can be, given what he's being forced to do. But yeah, when Scorpius is like, you know, hey, you're unique, and I want unique because I want just what's in your head. And then Bracca's like, hold the gun on him. He's like, what are you going to do, shoot him? It's like, you can't shoot him. I'm thinking this before John even goes crazy. I'm like, what are you going to do, kill him? You can't kill him, because if you kill him, then the whole thing's over, right? And John knows that too. And then he like has the whole hilarious freak-out scene where he's doing like the Blazing Saddles self-hostage thing, where it's like, you know, don't move, or he gets it, you know, with a pointing his fingers to his head like a gun. I was rolling on off the chair, because that's one of my favorite, no longer even close to politically correct movies. I love Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
And then he pulls the, you know, game over, you know, like the freak out with, you know, Hudson from Aliens too.
Yeah. In true Star-Lord fashions, he definitely gets to excel at pulling off the pop culture references.
Yeah, it was just the whole set piece was fantastic. And then to finish it off, when the ship's disintegrating around him and Brackett leaves with the spacesuit, it's like, well, how's he gonna get out of here? Well, you know, the transport pod's out there, just jump on out in space and jump over there. You use the gun to shoot yourself over there, and you know, also the explosion probably helped shove him over there. So all in all, that was a fantastic set piece, probably one of the best ones they've done in a while.
So I have a question there, because I didn't realize this until we were working on the recap earlier. The voice that he heard was Scorpius at that point?
Yeah. I mean, again, having seen the last two seasons, I know I have a good idea what that is, and it'd be interesting to see if this is where it starts. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. That confused me as somebody who has not seen an episode further than we've actually watched for the recaps. And yeah, I'll leave a point there that, all right, I'm confused and intrigued, and we'll move on.
Yeah, because in the last episode, John says like Scorpius is in his head, and then here he's actually now hears him. So I'm interested to see if that was related. I don't know.
And I wasn't in the best audio spot, so I didn't catch out whose voice that was. So I caught that there was a voice, but it's interesting now that I kind of know whose it was. Right, I'm not reading. I don't have captions on when I watch this. I missed that. So. Interesting.
Yeah, because the comm system was out. Otherwise, John would have called to say, don't shoot me, it's me. So, yeah, it was not like a transmission. So, yeah. So, it's interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
More to come on that. And then we have our Aaron, John, will they, won't they? Which we know they're going to eventually. But anyway. So, for now, you know, she still can't commit to John. Even when, you know, John's like, you know, this is it. And she's like, I'm not going to your wedding. And, or she's like, you know, you have to leave. You have to run away. And he says, with you? Okay, let's commit here, woman. And she's like, with all of us. Like, no! So, I mean, obviously this is building to the final episode where it all wraps up, and hopefully, you know, she he and her, you know, get some agreement or some happy state that they can move along the relationship, obviously.
Yeah, I'm terrible at predictions, in case we haven't established that. But my expectation is that's where this trilogy is taking us. It's kind of leading us to a point where they can get them together and move to new things to explore. Although, I gotta admit that until I was doing the recap, I'd forgotten that Erin did go to the Badlands. I remembered her shooting the guy down, but I'd forgotten that she went back after the last conversation with John and told him to try to keep up. So, I guess there's that. We'll see what happens with that next episode, too.
Yeah, because obviously they went, she's like, okay, well, John's given up. So, hey, dude, over here, strange guy, let's go. You know, okay, I don't know where that's going, but obviously nowhere, but we know that. But anyway, we'll see. And then I guess, as I alluded to way back at the beginning of the podcast, the ending of this episode is what I remember from watching it before. So I remember Crichton being turned into a statue and being like painfully like hunched over and like with his finger, whatever. It was hilarious. So I remember that versus like the cool poses he was trying to do, like with the, you know, the double, you know, victory sign, whatever he was trying to do with it, you know, before he got zapped into the wonderful pigeon crawling statue that he'll be there for 80 years. So
yeah, it was Chekhov's pose for sure, with the earlier mention of him thinking about heroic poses. I hate we missed the opportunity to have him waving in the Queen's wave for the 80 years, but, you know, we get what we get.
Yeah, I guess the wave wouldn't have worked out too well because it's not like a 3D. It's a 3D, but it's not like animatronic. It's not like his hand's not going to be moving for 80 years.
So. No, but still. We'd have got the reference.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he figured it'd just be a hologram, not a real statue, right? He didn't know that until it's like, say, what now?
Well, there's a statue and then there's a Yurda statue. That's two different things.
It's a whole different concept, yeah. And especially to be like sentient and aware for 80 years. That
and in pain.
That would probably drive anybody insane. I mean, even if you weren't in pain, just sitting there, not being able to move, breathe, and you're looking, you know, wherever they point you, you know.
Well, and think of how many people you're going to see pass away in 80 years, too. Why are you stuck there just looking?
Yeah. Not the best way to govern, but I guess it's worked so far for however many hundreds of years, so hey.
Yes, they're pretty stable, so maybe we should statuize some people and see what happens.
Yeah, somehow I don't think that would work out too well with our politicians, but anyway.
I can't
imagine that happening. I don't know. I don't think that would work out too well.
I'm just thinking if we never mind.
Yeah, insert your own political whatever and just go have fun with that.
Yep.
Because it works on any side. It's perfect. All right. So I guess quick wrap up since we knew we'd be running kind of long here since this is an action-packed couple of episodes. Like I said, I think these are probably the best two episodes of season two so far. You know, even counting like the cliffhanger ending of season one, the first episode of season two, that was good. So we'll keep those as like that three-parter. We'll make that a three-parter and lump it as season one. So far, this is the best of season two, I think. Love the political intrigue. Always love that kind of stuff, especially with sci-fi kind of stuff when you start lumping that kind of stuff into it. I love how the crew just acts clueless and just goes with the flow. Like, yeah, I'm working with the Skarrans. Yeah, I'm working with the Peacekeepers. Whatever, sure. Yeah, and let the people make up their own minds and, you know, kind of solve their own problem without committing anything. I love it. We finally get to see what a Skarran looks like, which was cool. So now we kind of can speculate on what Scorpius is or isn't or what he can and can't do. Speaking of which, Scorpius back. Yay! And he's still that sleazy, arrogant, scheming person that we've known and loved for these last couple episodes that we've seen him in. And, of course, we have romantic tension between Erin and Crichton. You know, will they or won't they? We know they will, but it's just a matter of how they get there. And they know tension at all. Dargo and Chiana romance.
So. I will second all of that. Not much to add. I'm a big fan of multi-parters. This seems to hit all those sweet spots I mentioned earlier. Yeah, you laid it out pretty well. I think we're moving into this next episode with high hopes and great expectations.
Yeah, so now having given all this big applause and gushing of emotions that we loved it, they better bring it home, man.
Yeah, they got to land this plane.
They
messed it up now.
Yeah. All right, speaking of which, so next time we have season 2, episode 13, Look at the Princess, part 3. The Maltese Crichton.
Longest title yet.
Yeah, that might. Might be. Have to get a character count.
We need some character counts. Yeah.
and episode 14, Beware of Dog. And I guess, well, we can't really play the guessing game about part three here. Obviously, the Maltese Crichtons play on the Maltese Falcon, since Crichton's a statue. Other than that, no idea. Otherwise, but we do know all the hanging plot threads that they have to, you know, get rid of, wrap up, or continue, like they do in callbacks later. Who knows? But so, you know, obviously Crichton can't be a statue. He has to get free somehow. Who's gonna marry Catrala? I'm assuming she will get married and not have the sleazebag brother become king. But you know, who's gonna marry her? Is it gonna be Tino? That weird cousin that keeps hitting on Aaron? Like, you know, that's cousins, royalty cousins marrying is not anything new. I mean, that's the entire European royal family is all related, so that's nothing out of the ordinary. But there's gotta be happy endings. I mean, you build this thing up, it's gotta end happily. And Aaron and John have to commit and move on. So we have to wrap all that up.
I think if I had to make a guess, and this is where I'm going to go crazy, I'm thinking that the cousin question mark that Aaron went to the Badlands with is going to end up leading like some kind of freedom resistance. He's going to actually end up being important. And they're going to figure out how to fix Catrala's DNA. And she can, or break the system either way. And she ends up marrying Tino. That's my pick.
Okay.
From the title, Maltese Crichton, that makes me think there will be a heist of some kind, because I've never seen it, but I would think the Maltese Crichton, I'm like, ha-ha. I think the Maltese Falcon was a detective / investigation type thing. I wonder if there's a heist / search for a Crichton statue. Something needs to happen there. So he can be the deus ex machina for them to search for.
Okay. We'll see. I don't know. I don't remember that episode at all. So I remember him being a statue. That's it. So I remember him being a statue. But
I'm going to laugh if you totally skipped that episode. And you know, yeah. You watch it. You're like, I did not see any of this.
I might. Who knows? I mean, I don't remember half some of the stuff. So we'll see what tickles the memory. And then finally, Beware of Dog. Okay, well, I mean, that's usually a sign they put up for, like, if you're guarding something or trespassing somewhere. So it's just like some kind of guardian that's not dog-like or like a dog or, you know, that kind of guardian creature. You know, are they trespassing like somewhere they shouldn't be? Are they stealing something from somewhere they shouldn't be? Or, I don't know, they pick up somebody and their guardian creature and something happens and it goes after the crew. I don't know. That's all I got.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm leaning towards the latter. I'm almost thinking it's been a while since we had a big ship episode where everything was kind of bottled on Moya. At least it feels that way because we've had some pretty big planet side stuff. So I kind of get a feeling we're going to have some dog / monster episode on Moya. But again, expecting me to be wrong.
Yeah, and after these big three-parter here with lots of, you know, extras and people and stuff, they probably go on the cheap. So maybe it might be a bottle type show with a limited guest cast, you know, stuck on Moya somewhere or something. So
yeah.
And they've done a lot of good creatures lately, so maybe this is another good creature shop moment where they build some kind of like fantastic, you know, feature space dog guardian thing. I don't know.
Is it the Keymaster and the Gate? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. It's not Zool. I forgot what the Gate.
It's always Zool.
Yeah. All roads lead to Zool. That's right. All right. So that is your homework for next time, episodes 13 and 14 of season 2. And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.